Yeah, Prabhupada said, everything we need to know to go back to Godhead is in this first canto. So we're preparing ourselves to go back to Godhead. So this is... In the first canto, like Bhagavad Gita, when you read it for the first time, it's wonderful. You read it again, and there's so many things that you didn't pick up on the first time you read it. The second, third time you read it, there's so many other things. And then by the time you're reading it the fourth time and the fifth time, it just grows on you, and it becomes part of how you see the world. Srimad Bhagavatam is like that. It's very personal. So it's like having a relationship with Krishna. Reading Srimad Bhagavatam regularly, it's like having a relationship with Krishna, and Krishna is with you. Krishna stays with you. He's already with us, but you know, we're kind of like ignoring him or trying to pay attention but not really trying to pay attention, or trying to pay attention but not really trying to pay attention. And so he reciprocates with us accordingly, and we try to pay more careful attention than you can feel Krishna's presence just from associating very nicely with Srimad Bhagavatam. So here we go. I can say, you know, that as I'm going through one more time through this first canto, there are verses where, just like last couple of days, we discussed some verses that Prabhupada would quote again and again. Tashyaiva heto prayateta kovido, that verse. Chaktvasva dharmam charanam bhujam harir bhajana pakto tapatetato yadi. So it just like resonates with years of having heard those verses, and Prabhupada explained them in so many ways. It's like the verse where Vyasadeva is instructing Yudhisthira Maharaj on how to perform his duties as king in chapter 9. And then the sun starts to move in the northerly direction, and it's described that, you know, so the great Bhishma Dev, who spoke so many verses and so many occasions and filled the hearts and the minds and the ears of the Pandavas, suddenly grew silent. And one can hear the birds chirping on the treetops. Like, so poetic. He just withdrew, but his consciousness, consolidated his consciousness completely upon the personality of Godhead. While having done so in practice throughout his life, in service to the Supreme Lord, when it came time for death, it was, for choosing his moment of death, it was very as easy as that, because his consciousness was already there. So similarly, these verses, having heard Prabhupada speak them, describe them in so many ways, in so many different occasions, when you read them again, it's like being home. It's being with Prabhupada and being with Krishna. The Bhagavatam has a way of, it's magical. It's everything that it says in the Bhagavatam that it is. It's the literary form of the Supreme Lord. When Krishna departed, like the setting of the sun on the western horizon, shortly after, on the eastern horizon, the full moon arose, as brilliant as the sun, in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam, giving light into the darkened age of Kali. It was so poetic. And that's the way it works. If one stands and basks in that brilliant as the sun light, then there's light in this dark age. Had a just before coming here to Boston, I was in Champaign-Urbana, the University of Illinois, and just as at Tufts and MIT, I spoke on the same subject, this spiritual economics topic, and one fellow gentleman, professor, I guess, or at least a well-educated man, articulate man, was expressing, you know, you presented very nicely what the problem is with materialistic economics or consumer economics, what the impact is on the individual, what the impact is on interrelationships, what the impact is upon the environment. And it's easy to acknowledge all of that, but how to turn it around? Because the machinery is very powerful. So my reply was two parts. I said, you look about the same age as me. When we were going to college, what was the phrase? The military-industrial complex. Down with the pigs. His face lit up like, oh, you're from the same generation. But, you know, all those people that were saying, down with the pigs, where are they now? They were put in jail, you know, because they were the protesters. And the government knew exactly what to do with those people. And so, here we are today, and is the machinery, the military-industrial complex any different? Powerful government, industry, media, the whole machinery, is it any weaker today than it was before? These guys are powerful. So how are you going to stop it? So Vyas, he saw it coming. Here comes the glacier. And a mountain gets in the way and it knocks over the mountain. Just grinds it into powder. No problem for a glacier. But Vyasadeva and Narada, they were a good team. And what we're going to read today is Narada is calling, is identifying that Vyas is a not just an empowered incarnation, like as in a Shaktivesh avatar, that he is, but he's Kala, meaning he's the personality of Godhead. Kala is a Sanskrit term that Prabhupada used or translated as a portion of a plenary portion, meaning there's Narayan in Vaikuntha. And he expands as Sankarshan, and Sankarshan then expands as the Vishnu Tattva. So he's in the category of Vishnu Tattva. He's empowered, but he's also Krishna. And Prabhupada is going to explain. Although he's Krishna, he's instructing that even such a powerful person as Vyas requires a spiritual master such as Narada, and so that sets the standard for us. Like Krishna, he also accepted as a spiritual master Sandipani or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted as a spiritual master Ishvara Puri. And he became bewildered. How can the personality of Godhead become bewildered? He's behaving like that for our edification, so that we can hear from Narada and his bewilderment is not the same as ours, or our bewilderment is not the same as his. Any more than, just like the comment from yesterday, when Krishna was sent away by Lalita and Vishakha, you can't see Radha. Krishna became very sad. Now our sadness is on another platform. Krishna's is, it's Leela. It's just a variety of loving dealing, and our sadness is due to attachment. Not a variety of loving dealing, not a variety of ecstasy. Our sadness is a variety of illusion. And our happiness is a variety of illusion, and Krishna's happiness is a variety of ecstasy. So, two different platforms. This realm is a perverted reflection of that realm. And it takes some, at least it takes some discerning, some like little modest amount of separating the two, Krishna and us. But the, as Krishna consciousness evolves and progresses and develops, then one has no interest at all and the other is transcendentally attractive. But worldly people can't make that distinction. But there's clearly a distinction. So Vyas is being instructed by Narada on what that distinction is, because what happened in the fourth chapter was Vyas being the phrase that Narada uses is amogadrik. He could see perfectly. Just like, you know, we can, in a very imperfect way, we can see, you know, our hand in front of our face. But Vyas could see perfectly, not only present, but past and future equally well, and better than we can see our hand in front of our face. So because he wasn't covered by material conceptions or material attraction, even. He was fully realized in the nature of the absolute truth. He was perfect in his vows. There's a long list of things that are describing his perfection. And because of those qualifications, he could see in the coming age of Kali, because the Bhagavatam was written, the Vedas were divided, just about the time of the end of Dwarapa Yuga. So Kali Yuga had not kicked in yet, but he could see what was going to happen in Kali Yuga. He could see the glacier coming. He could see what we're experiencing. And he was very concerned. And he thought, what's the root of the problem, and then how to address the root of the problem? And the root of the problem is, in this age of Kali, people are too much attracted to, enamored by, and attached to matter, although they're spirit soul. There's no happiness to be found in matter, and too much attached to matter. And so because they're too much attached to matter, consciousness of the soul covered over, consciousness of the relationship with Krishna double covered over, chasing after matter, finding frustration in the chase, becoming angry and violent because of that frustration. So we have to remove this covering of matter. There's too much affinity for matter. So he saw as the cure the literary work of the Vedic composition, which would slowly, ever so slowly, through lifetimes of gradual detachment from matter. And so that was his path, and he completed it. He took the Veda, which originally was one, divided it into four, and then explained it all from the same literature, from the same Vedic texts in the Smritis. He explained the Shrutis, and then he wrote Vedanta Sutra to kind of like tie it all up with a nice little bow and ribbon in the top, and then considered how well the product came out. And when he looked at the product and looked inside himself, he felt yuck. I don't feel right. What did I do wrong? What's missing? He was pondering on this feeling. Because he was just being honest with himself. We're often dishonest with ourselves. We don't allow ourselves to feel those feelings, although we know that those feelings are there. Something's missing. But he was honest, and so he acknowledged that feeling that was there. Something's missing. And just as he was deeply pondering, Narada Muni, his spiritual master, came in for a special landing and said, "Yes, you don't look so good. What's the matter?" That's the end of chapter 4. And chapter 5 begins with Vyas saying, "I don't know. I did this right, I did that right. I'm looking at the things that I was supposed to do, and I did all the things I was supposed to do. But I'm feeling yuck. So, what happened? You're in touch with Super Soul. You're the direct son of Brahma who heard it directly from the personality of Godhead himself, and he taught you, so you must know. Why am I feeling like this?" And Narada gave a hint. The hint was pretty clear. "Oh, learned son of Parashara Muni," in other words, invoking, "you're the son of such a perfected rishi. Surely you must know better than... Are you finding satisfaction in the object of self-realization to be the body? Or the mind?" Because the Sanskrit word atma can mean any one of those. It can mean body or mind, or it can mean the soul. "Oh, learned son of Parashara, atma means body and mind, and that's what the Vedas are for, is to bring satisfaction and happiness to the body and the mind, and that's self-realization." So that was the hint. That was so like, you make a long mathematical calculation, make a mistake at the very beginning, and everything is wrong. So the fundamental conception of self has to be addressed. Following that fundamental mistake, he then certified, "Oh, learned Vyas, you did this right, you did that right, you made all your other calculations right. But your little boo-boo was over here at the very beginning. So now you've got to go back and recalculate the whole thing. But first you've got to get the first one right." And how are you going to get the first one right? He gave it the formula of Vyas, you are this Amoghadrik personality. You can meditate. You can fix your mind completely because you have no material attraction. You have no material motives. You have realization of Brahman. Fix your mind upon the personality of Godhead again and again, hearing and remembering His glories, His form, His qualities, His pastimes. Fix that in your consciousness and then describe that. In a literature that's unmixed with any of this other fruitive intention stuff, because, oh Vyas, when you put the fruitive intention stuff in the Vedas, the ordinary people who are addicted to that stuff say, oh look, it's bona fide. It's authorized. Vyas authorized it. Fruitive activities, kijai. He said, it's quite unreasonable for you to have done like this. So one literature should be composed that's just exclusively describing the personality of Godhead and His wonderful devotees who are likewise empowered by Him to deliver Him. Describe those things. Now here's what he said, that the concern that you have about this covering of the living entities in Kali Yuga particularly, don't worry Vyasa, it'll be taken care of. Here's how it'll be taken care of. If you speak this message and write this message and they repeat the message of the personality of Godhead, because He's all pure, they'll become pure in contact with the all pure, the supreme pure. That's the formula. Now, supposing you think they're not going to get it because they don't have the qualification. You're right. They don't have the qualification to get it. But still, the supreme pure is supremely pure. So even if they don't get it, they'll be uplifted and purified at the soul level. Then he gives this nice verse. Chatvasva dharmam charanam bhujam harir. That is, even if, Vyas, let's suppose somebody goes down this path of hearing and chanting about Krishna, and they get a little purified, and in that purified state they get some attraction for the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead. But due to bad association or some other circumstance, they again desist. They stop. They fall back into a material condition of life. That person is better off than the person who doesn't take up the process of hearing and chanting, remembering the personality of Godhead. And they do all those other things that you described, all those other good things. And they do them perfectly. But their attraction for the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead doesn't awaken. That amounts to nothing from the spiritual perspective compared to some awakening of attraction for the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead. So better you do this other one. Then he says, that person who, if that person does fall from the path of, let's say, sadhana bhakti, they'll never be able to go back to being a covered karmi, a fruitive worker that doesn't have any attraction at all. They'll never be the same. So, you've been notified. You're on notice here by Narada Muni that your life will never be the same. That once attraction for Krishna, just here's what Prabhupada said to one devotee, you know, back in the 1966 era, Prabhupada said, if you can simply chant Krishna's name once, without offense, then that's sufficient to awaken your full love of God, and you're on your way back home, back to Godhead. Just once. And every day, if we're chanting 16 rounds, we have 25,000 chances. So that's very fortunate. Shut it off. Just once. So Narada is saying something similar. If just once one gets an appreciation of the shadow or the reflection of Krishna's lotus feet, that's like Namabhas, chanting of Namabhas or Bhakti Abhas, just a reflection of devotional service according to Nectar of Devotion, can give one some feelings of ecstasy. But that's just a reflection. What to speak of the real thing? So powerful. It's like, you know, it's the formula for melting the glacier. The stone-like hearts of people in the age of Kali can be softened. At least what I said to this gentleman at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, I said, at least the innocent persons can be given shelter. Those persons that are, how should we put it, you know, hardcore atheists or like card-carrying asuras, that's going to take Krishna to come with the Sudarshan Chakra and finish them. But for those that are innocent, which is what Prabhupada said most people are, they're simply innocent. And because the atmosphere is so degraded, people become degraded in bad association. So those innocent persons, who are largely the population, at least the opportunity can be given that they can, you know, get off this moving train that's heading towards a brick wall before it crashes. The craziness of Kali Yuga. The formula is this contacting of the soul and contacting on the soul level, contacting Krishna through this message of Srimad Bhagavatam. So what's being laid out here by Narada to Vyasa is, here's what this text should be, so that the reader knows, even before going into the text, this is what we're going to get. This is like the anatomy of Srimad Bhagavatam. Before you go into, you know, medical practice, you learn anatomy. And here's the anatomy of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's that literature which places the topics of Krishna right in the front. The purpose of it is to bring light into the darkened condition of heart, remove the coverings of ignorance, and on the platform of the soul, feel some attraction for Krishna. Experience that. And even if it's not, if in the course of this lifetime one doesn't cross the finish line, like become a pure devotee of the Lord and go back to Godhead, I heard it from Prabhupada directly speaking. He understood. Prabhupada was saying in an assembly that was maybe three times as many people as here today. Many persons become attracted to Krishna consciousness, and they do so out of sentiment. And after some time, they may go away. Prabhupada was being really explicit. And he said, but there are some who are very sincere, and they stay with this process. And so his comment in a particular lecture was, initiation is for those who are very serious. But everyone can benefit. The Srimad Bhagavatam was passed out to everybody to read and benefit. And some persons took it seriously. And those persons that took it seriously and stayed with it had this light that came into the heart and received the benefit that Bhagavatam was meant to give. I'm just now summarizing where we ended up yesterday morning. Another very, so this Tashyaiva Heto Prayateta Kovido verse, Nalabhyate Yad Brahmatam Uparyadha Talabhyate Dukavad Anyata Sukham Kalina Sarvatra Gambira Ramhasa. Even it sounds nice. Persons who are actually intelligent, as distinct from those who think they are, but they aren't. Those who are actually intelligent, Kovida, like Kavi, like Krishna Das, Kaviraj, Kavi, learned it. Those who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end which is not obtainable even by wandering from the topmost planet down to the lowest. Like, so something otherworldly, something that's eternal. They should search for Sat and become detached from Asat. Now, most minds that I've ever encountered, they're attracted to Sat, to Asat. In fact, just listening to Prabhupada describe that, for the most part, people just take dictation from the mind. And the mind says, I want to enjoy. And then the varieties of enjoyment are dictated to by the senses that say, I want this object. And then the mind says, Mr. Intelligence, please come here. Yes, sir. Reporting for duty, sir. I want to enjoy that object. Oh, I can get that object. I'm sure I can get that object. I may have to go to school for a number of years, but I can surely get you that object. And as long as you hire me, I'll be in your service. Yes, sir. And so the intelligence serves the mind, which serves the senses. But the mind is the king. The mind rules. And as the mind dictates, that's what we think we want. And we're following the mind. And the whole program of spiritual life says, my dear Mr. Mind, please sit down. What do you mean sit down? I'm in charge. No, not anymore. For lifetimes you've been in charge and you haven't been doing a good job. I'm not going to fire you, but you're being demoted. You just obey. You're over here. So the mind rebels at that kind of message, but that's spiritual practice. We want to put the intelligence in the driver's seat. Because that is specifically that intelligence that says, here's how you get to Krishna. But where do you get that intelligence? You get that intelligence from Krishna. The dami buddhiyogam tam yena mamupiyantite. And Krishna gives that intelligence. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. He gives it to those who are constantly endeavoring. Very key word. Endeavoring, striving, trying, making some effort to please Krishna with your activities. When someone is trying like that, then Krishna says, aha, this is a person I'd like to give that kind of intelligence by which they can come to me. We can't get it at Walmart, or can't get it at the university. You can't get it from hanging out with your friends. You can get it from Krishna. He's got a soul franchise. And he can give that intelligence to one who is sincere. How to come to him? And he reserves the right to give another kind of intelligence to people who want other kinds of stuff. Although the message is very clear and it's open, it's an open secret. But people don't get it because they don't want to get it. But it's that simple.
A small one.
And so Vyas is being instructed by Narada. There's the kavis, there's the learned persons who have this very, very special capacity of not being attracted to anything in this world of duality. They only want that which is fully spiritual. Wise and thoughtful people look for that. Write for those people, give them Krishna, and the other people, give them Krishna. Because they'll be purified. And you know how to write so that people are attracted, so you write. This is your thing. You're a gifted writer. Write for those persons. And then, so now, the verse, the continuing text, this is text 19 and 20 from chapter 5. Narada says, "My dear Vyas, the Supreme Lord, personality of Godhead, is himself this cosmos, and still he is aloof from it." This is philosophy. All of the other stuff was fun. Now we're going into philosophy, so sorry about that, but it's in the Bhagavatam. "For him only has this cosmic manifestation, from him only has this cosmic manifestation emanated. It rests in him, and unto him it enters after annihilation. Your good self knows all about this. I have given only a synopsis." So, 2.5 page purport later, Prabhupada is describing the relationship. It's important to understand the relationship between, you know, this place where we're hanging out now and this source of emanation. Because if we don't understand the relationship between this place and its source of emanation, then we've got this, like, schizophrenia going on. We want to become Krishna conscious, but we can't relate to the situation that we're in as part of being Krishna conscious. So we're trying to be spiritual, but in the material world. So there's some problem in doing that. Like, how do you put the two things together? Like, people will say, the way that they often say it is, how do you balance your spiritual and material life? And the answer is, you don't balance your spiritual and material life. You make everything spiritual. Because this is in relation to Krishna, and therefore it has its spiritual potential. You just have to do the direct spiritual activities so that these activities have the same delivering potency as your direct spiritual activities. At least according to the personality of Godhead to Lord Brahma, that's what he says. So to do that, you put the first things first. You put your That's not a choo-choo train. That's something else. Okay. You put your activities that directly connect your consciousness with Krishna in place, in your life, or in your day, or in your, you know, your plan. And then all the other things are connected to that, and all the other things become energized by that. Then the direction, the intelligence to see things connected to the personality of Godhead is yours. And that's what Vyasa is being told by Narada. "Oh, learned Narada, you know perfectly well the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the source of emanation of this material world. And he is sustaining it, and unto him, this cosmic manifestation is withdrawn. So make sure that this is understood in this literature that you write. So he's following Narada's instructions. It's many places in the Bhagavatam, because our materialistic problem is we don't see that. And because we don't see that, it means it doesn't belong to anybody. So it's up for grabs. You can make it yours. I was visiting in Alaska. I learned some things when I was visiting. Learned a lot of things when I was visiting in Alaska. One of the things was how powerful is nature. How ancient and powerful is nature. That's one of the things I learned. Then another thing I learned was some of the history of Alaska. And just to make it a little graphic and warm, we were flying in a Piper Cub because the person I was visiting was really like determined. He wanted me to go with, you know, right up to the foot of Mount McKinley and like check it out, because it's so awesome, so powerful. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to just have a peaceful, quiet time. That's what I went for. But he was very excited, so we went. And we're flying at 10,000 feet, look out, little noisy Piper Cub, and you know, there's all these ranges of forest and tundra and mountains and power. I said, you know, how long have you been doing this, flying this Piper Cub? He said, 38 years. I said, wow. And over those 38 years, have you noticed some changes over here? And he said two things. See that over there? That's a glacier. It used to come all the way down to where we are now. Miles, like, you know, 50 miles, and it just melted. See all those lakes? That used to be glacier.
Look, that's my picture.
And then see over there? See that forest? The whole thing used to be forest. But when, what's his name? Seward. William Seward. He bought Alaska from Russia for $4 million. And so it wasn't made a state yet. It was just a United States territory. So it was the United States territory, and the loggers came in, and it was romper room because there was no law of the United States restricting what they could do. So they just stripped out the lumber, which was the habitat for, you know, who knows how many living beings, and just, you know, gone. See, all that area that used to be a forest, now it's stripped because there wasn't any regulation. That means doesn't belong to anybody. I'll make it mine. And that's the way of people in this world. It doesn't belong to God. That guy over there thinks it belongs to him. I'll show him. I'm stronger. It's mine. Might makes right. Move over, buddy. It's mine. And so it's nasty. It's not like it only happened in Alaska. It's still happening today. Just in the news, this, you know, the people that are going stripping out the Amazon forest, and the Brazilian government said, hey guys, get out of here. And they said, no, we're not getting out of here. And they sent their military, get out of here. So they, you know, got out of there. But, you know, who's stronger? It's just like animals. And that's the way of godless life. It's human form of life acting like animals. Because it doesn't belong to anybody. Make it yours. Really nasty. In the name of civilization. Oh, one other thing that just happened. Dalai Lama was visiting in Seattle when just after Alaska. I was in Seattle. And Hari Vilas is the temple president and GBC. So he went to the Dalai Lama whatever it's called, assembly, conference in a football stadium, 50,000 people cheering Dalai Lama, and he was, you know, he was an impressive speaker, a very learned, intellectual person. They had a question-answer session out of 50,000 people, and the first question was, in our country, or did I say, in the world today, there are people that believe that if you don't get your way, you just make some military show of force and you get your way. And, you know, I don't feel that that's right. But what can we do to stop that happening in the world today? And Dalai Lama got real excited and said, that's such an important question. We should speak simply about this question. It's so important. And the answer is, I don't have the answer. Parvilas said, I practically got up and walked out. I was, you know, on the edge of my seat. Here's Dalai Lama, you know, the modern Gandhi, going to tell us about how to stop, you know, aggression in the world. Buddhist, Dalai Lama. I don't know. Well, you know, Vyasadeva knows. He's not bluffing. Because he can see. He can see the material before it happens, and he can see the material, the spiritual solution. And there is a spiritual solution. That spiritual solution, in a nutshell, is sound vibration of the name, form, qualities, and pastimes, and personality of Godhead, which gets at the root of the problem. Once again, what's the root of the problem? Too much affinity for matter, although we're spirit soul. If you don't have a spiritual solution, you've got no solution. And it's not a solution, just the mode of goodness, because Vyas went down that path. Promote people to the mode of goodness through incrementally gradual elevation through sacrifice. To the mode of goodness. So you can do your exploitation in the mode of goodness. It wasn't satisfying to Vyas. It's not going to be satisfying to the person who practices it, nor to Dalai Lama or any other person. But what's the solution? The solution is gotta come from someone who is a mogadrik, that's able to see the personality of Godhead. And the relationship of all things with the personality of Godhead. So that's the first part of the purport. Prabhupada is explaining that this is Vedanta. Everything comes from Brahman. You ever pondered over that? Like, sarvam kalvidam brahma. What does that mean? It sounds like impersonalism. And so Prabhupada writes, the impersonal cosmic manifestation is also Mukunda, because it is the emanation of the energy of Mukunda. Thus, for the pure devotee, the concept of Mukunda, Lord Sri Krishna, is both personal and impersonal. Sarvam kalv idam brahma, that everything is Brahman, means that everything comes from Brahman. Here Prabhupada writes, the Vedic version that the whole cosmic creation is nothing but Brahman means that since everything is emanating from Supreme Brahman, nothing is apart from Him. Then he gives this example, and I heard it in a class spoken in Los Angeles just this morning when I was having breakfast. He gives the example of your hand. Like, it's really gruesome. Cut off your hand, throw it on the ground, and ugh. Although it's a hand, it's disgusting. You'd walk down the street and saw a hand lying on the ground. I mean, ooh. But then you have an expert physician that knows how to do it, and he puts it back on the body, and then it's useful. Then it's not, ooh, it's something very valuable. So, when the individual soul is disconnected from the Supreme, they see matter also disconnected from its source of emanation, and you have a society that's very ugly. Although it shouldn't be, it's from the Supreme. It's just the consciousness of seeing things separate from the Supreme That creates the ugliness. Then you have the Amazon forest cutters, and you have the Brazilian government trying to keep them, you know, stop these guys. But they got to have those resources because they got to produce so people can consume, so they can make their profit and make a booming economy. We're running out of resources. I'm sure something's going to happen to, you know, try to pull that Brazilian leader guy out of power and put somebody else in that's going to let them come in and cut down those trees and get those resources. They'll figure out a way to try to cut that guy down to size and get their resources. Because it's not about, you know, who does everything ultimately belong to? It's about, let me make it mine. So Prabhupada writes, a godless civilization detached from the transcendental living service of the personality of God, it is just like a detached hand or leg. Such parts and parcels may appear like hands and legs, but they have no efficiency. So the devotee, although the numbers of very powerful materialists is very great, and they stand united to, you know, control things, the power of being connected with the personality of God, it is also not to be underestimated. It's stronger. The power of the personality of God, it is there, and the power of this message is also very powerful. At least those who are the innocent persons should have this opportunity, and they'll become attracted to it because it's an alternative to this other ugly matter before us. So I think I'll just read one more thing here. Your goodness has perfect vision. Again, he same as like same as 10 texts earlier, he's referring to Vyas as, you have perfect vision. He's reminding him, Vyas, don't get bewildered. You have perfect vision. Here's the direction that you should follow. You yourself can know the Supreme Personality of Godhead because you are present as the plenary portion of the Lord. You're an expansion, direct expansion of the Personality of Godhead. Although you are birthless, you have appeared on this earth for the well-being of all people. Please, therefore, describe the transcendental pastimes of the Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, more vividly. So it's like the question was raised the other day. Isn't the description of Krishna also in Bhagavad Gita? I mean, yes, it's in Bhagavad Gita, but there's so many other subject matters in Bhagavad Gita, in Mahabharata, that although the real jewel and the centerpiece of the whole Mahabharata, many people they're so attracted by the story and the history and the skullduggery and who did it to whom and the details of, you know, the storyline, and but also higher things like ethics and morals, that the supremacy of Krishna kind of doesn't capture them. And even those that are philosophically inclined, they take Bhagavad Gita and twist it and turn it so you don't even recognize it anymore and call it Bhagavad Gita. It's their own philosophy superimposed on Bhagavad Gita instead of Krishna's own words. Like, don't surrender to Krishna. Surrender to the unborn, unmanifest within Krishna. That's what he really means. Things like that. So, the fallen and forgotten souls are detached from the transparent loving service of the Lord. So this literature, the Bhagavatam, is to, again, attach them to the service of the Lord. It's this, like the example, taking the ham that's detached from the body and again attaching it to the body by surgery. So this is a process of taking the individual or society and connecting them to the Supreme, connecting matter again to the source of matter, seeing the relationship and acting accordingly. Shouldn't be so hard. The only thing that makes it hard is we don't want to. That's what's hard. It's hard to change the heart of the conditioned soul. But the procedure is not so difficult. So this Bhagavatam is, Narada is empowering Vyas to compose a literature that accomplishes those things. And our business, our service, is to follow Vyas. The things that Prabhupada explains it in the purports, all these wonderful qualifications that are qualifications of Vyas are supposed to be cultivated by the followers of Vyas so that we can also present properly this message, starting with our own life and then our words and our relationships with others and how we deal with nature. And that's not going to change without a change of consciousness, so it starts there. That's how the Srimad Bhagavatam works. Okay, I'll stop with that and see if anybody would like to discuss any points.
It's me, orange. Red banana.
Yeah.
Maharaj, could you talk a little more about the difference between spiritual intelligence and material intelligence?
Sure. It's a world of difference. Material intelligence is serving the dictates of the mind to gather together the resources of nature, put them together in such a way that whatever the mind thinks is happiness, the intelligence puts it together. It's the servant of the mind. And spiritual intelligence is a direction. Prabhupada uses the word form, direction of the Lord, of how to reach Him. Material intelligence is a covering of the soul, and spiritual intelligence is a direct spiritual capacity given by Krishna directly to reach Him. It gives us direction in life, how to reach Krishna. Material intelligence gives us direction how to combine the resources of material nature in such a way that the desires of the mind are addressed. Desire of the polluted mind. It's just upside down. The senses are demanding. The demand goes to the mind. The mind dictates to the intelligence. The intelligence serves them both. Material intelligence. Andham tamahak pravashanti ye vidyam upasate. Material intelligence takes one downward. Yes?
I have friends who are lost in emotions, like they believe in emotions, and I don't know how to communicate to them. I wondered if you might... Like they believe in anger, they believe in blame, they believe in unhappiness, they believe in all kinds of things that hold them down. And I'm always puzzled on how to communicate beyond that.
Prashadam? Chanting?
That's a challenge.
They believe in anger and violence, but they don't believe in chanting and prajadam?
I don't think they know about it.
Okay.
And I wouldn't know how to tell them about it.
You have to tell them. Just invite them to a kirtan. And just give them some prasadam. Just keep giving them prasadam. Don't even have to tell them.
I might have to make the prasadam myself.
Oh, so yeah, make prasadam yourself. Mm-hmm. Here's some. I just baked something. Why don't you check it out? It's nice.
Thank you for that.
And just like, in other words, agyata sukriti, purification. They don't even know what's happening. That's my suggestion.
Now you give me a reason for cooking.
Uh-huh. Well, my first thought went to, like, you know, get a big pin and pop their bubble. But it sounds like somebody like this has a bunch of bubbles. And
almost all my pins.
Okay, so The discussion on the science of Krishna consciousness, they may not want to hear. But the chanting of the holy name, they may be happy to hear. I mean, no, just like they chant the kirtan before, very nice. Very nice. Very nice. There has to be some little spark before you can fan it.
Most of them believe in God.
Okay.
That's a spark.
Fan the spark. But if, you know, they have, as you said, belief, they believe in anger and they believe in all these other things, what are you going to do? So without their, that's why I made the suggestions that I made.
Good one.
Okay. Sweta, you have something?
You had mentioned that root problems are usually too much attached to matter.
That's what Narada said.
Now, if you look at the practical application of it, it's usually because of identity crisis or it's because of a fear.
It's just, those are varieties of the one main thing. There's subcategories of the head cat. The lead category is, you know, too much attachment to matter. It can be lust. It can be, I want power. This represents power. I want power. It doesn't have to be fear or some of the other things. There's just varieties of this one thing. It's too much attachment. So whatever the downstream manifestation of that attachment is, that's the root. It's like, you know, you have weeds in your lawn, so go mow your lawn. But what happens? The weeds are going to grow again because the root's still there. But one has to address the root. So with fear or whatever the other things you mentioned, you know, that's like, so you cut the leaves so they don't, you know, they don't have that embarrassing thing over there anymore. But the root is still there. It's the attachment to the, I want to enjoy matter. My existence is to enjoy matter.
So why are we attached to that anyway?
Why? It's foolish. There's no good reason. The reason is we want to enjoy separate from Krishna. It's our bad attitude towards Krishna. We want to be the enjoyer. Why him all the time? Equal opportunity. At least I should some of the time be entitled to be the enjoyer. It's only fair. Let's take a vote on it. So that's the problem. The problem of that attachment to matter has its root also. That is, this, the whole of the material circumstances are aversion to Krishna. Raga, dvesha, samutina, dvandva, mohina, bharata. According to Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, too much attachment to matter. And then there's the varieties of things that we do from too much attachment to matter, and then trying to address the problem of how we got a problem because of trying to enjoy matter in the wrong way. Just, you know, tweak it a little bit, see if we can enjoy matter better in a different way. But that's not the solution to the problem. Yes. Arvind.
Maharaj, hearing for a while now from you and other devotees, it appears to me that the world is degrading so fast and there are so many clear signs of this disaster in waiting. It also seems like as devotees who are exposed to this wonderful knowledge of the Bhagavatam, sometimes I feel like not able to do enough to prepare for that. Like most of the time, my own life, I mean, I see in the life of other devotees, large part of our time goes in fixing broken relationships, even within devotee communities.
Sure.
So sometimes I get confused. What is my role here? Because it seems like time is running out.
Do those things in Krishna consciousness. Do those things in such a way that the core relationship with Krishna is nurtured. Don't neglect your core relationship with Krishna while going around trying to fix broken things, like broken relationships. Let that be done in Krishna consciousness. Let your occupation be done in Krishna consciousness. Let each thing be done in Krishna consciousness. And how that can be most effectively done is proper sadhana, proper chanting, and proper hearing. Then you're prepared. Best prepared. Yes?
Maharaj, I have a question. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna encourages Arjuna to fight.
Yeah,
and then you have a benefit from it to understand that actually we are the spirit soul, not this body.
Right.
2 days ago, me and my wife were watching documentary film about Quran and
Islam,
and I was shocking that actually in their religion it is said that you have to kill anybody who is against Islam, and it's written in Quran, right? So my
Is it an interpretation of the Quran or is it in the Quran?
No, they were scholars of
Islam,
and they were Islamic. All Islamic people. None of them were not of other denomination. And one of them was a former jihadi, and they were quoting word for word verses from Quran. And they were explaining, the title of the documentary is Islam, What West Needs to Know About It. And they say the West, and they were quoting, they were showing Tony Blair and Bush and other heads of the countries portraying Islam as a peaceful religion and the terrorists being only deviated part of it. And those scholars of Islam who publish other books, and during that movie the title of the books that their publisher presented, they said that West, you know, that West needs to know that it's just the other way around. West looks at the terrorist groups as a small group of deviated from Quran extremists. From teachings of Quran extremists. He says, well, it's just the other way around. Those who are who assimilated into the Western way of living and Western way of thinking, those people are deviating from teachings of the Quran. So therefore, fact that disturbs a lot of Westerners that Muslims don't stand up against terrorists is easy to explain by the fact that they cannot, because they know that by not being violent, they are deviated from Quran. Therefore, they have no right to stand up against their own religion that they deviated from. And they say that. So all the terrorist groups are actually trying to go to the root of the teachings of the Quran, and they are quoting the Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, exact words how he is teaching to deal with other religions and atheists, and in graphic pictures how to torture them even, and they quote numbers of those that he killed themselves, the beginning with Jews.
About 500 to 900 Jews.
Yes.
Jews.
And so
Muhammad killed himself.
It was so disturbing to watch, especially very, very disturbing was what I heard from that former jihadi who was doing those things in the name of Quran and in the name of the teachings that were passed to him by his parents. And I could not help thinking, Prabhupada once said that that's what is most disturbing to me. I cannot reconcile this, because Prabhupada once said that all religions are on this world are about the same God. It's just that the God has different names in different religions, and now the representatives are also authorized.
Well, not being a scholar of the Quran, I can't comment other than saying, well, say it in two different ways. I'm sure that one could get a panel of scholars that would have a 180-degree opposite opinion of those set of scholars, saying as convincingly as those scholars you heard the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Or say the same thing another way. One could, my guess is, get a group of, you know, people who were once part of ISKCON, who have now broken off from ISKCON, get those people together and say something. So that there's a panel that says a bunch of stuff, you know, that's interesting, but it's not compelling.
What is
compelling
to me is that they are giving
what's the
number of verses.
Okay. But you know, how many versions of Bhagavad Gita did you read before you read Prabhupada's? And of those versions of Bhagavad Gita, how many of them say impersonal? And that's what it says. It says impersonal. You got those people over there, you know, the personalists, mm-hmm. and they've just twisted everything around the other wrong way. You know, they have. Intellectual people make assertions like that. It's not new. So, and then, you know, they're intellectual, so they can present things in a very convincing way. So I'm not so sure. So, you know, I got a bunch of hands up in the air. You want
to kind of give a different perspective of Islam or of our culture. A group in today's society who chose to take every word of Manu Samhita literally might also, you know, run into some conflict with modern governments and, you know, put that into practice in a culture that wasn't culture.
Yeah, say the same thing that he's saying from you know, what both of you just said. You could get some scholars that say, you know, you look at Bhagavad Gita, here's the verse, and here's the verse, and here's the verse. Here's what the verse says, And what this text is really doing, say, take up your weapons. Go and fight. Look at this verse. Right from Bhagavad Gita. Now here's some from Mahabharata. Look at all this stuff going on. That's what this text is about. And those people that are off, you know, clanging tambourines and banging on drums on the streets, they're the deviated ones. The real scoop is this Bhagavad Gita is diabolical. I suppose you could get a group of people together and say that. So, I'm not convinced by that kind of dialogue. Yeah.
This is going back to another topic.
Thank you very much. I was looking at my watch thinking, oh my God, are we going to go down this?
Yeah. Question is, as attempting to become devotees, and we're, you know, attempting to overcome this desire to lord it over material nature for ourselves, so as we're doing this, and then this idea of balancing your life, what legitimacy is there to this concept of perhaps losing one or two battles to win an entire war? How should a devotee in their life think or act in the sense that, okay, I have a lifelong plan to try to become, you know, Krishna conscious, but as I'm experiencing difficulties, I'm finding that my mind is too difficult, perhaps, that it's too difficult to get past this difficulty at this time, so I give in to this difficulty, but I don't let it knock me off, then I continue. So what legitimacy is there in that, in devotees' accounts?
That's legit. I don't know if the response is give in to it, I don't think that's good. I think if the response is here comes a tsunami.
That's a good
one. And here's what Prabhupada speaks about when the Apichetsadharacharo verse is explained. If there's some overwhelming circumstance and one just becomes deviated from the path, the test of their sincerity is when that overwhelming circumstance subsides, where they stand. And they immediately resume their devotional service. That's the indicator of their sincerity. Circumstances overwhelming, they get overwhelmed. But their sincerity doesn't get overwhelmed, it's just they're overwhelmed. It's not, that's different than giving into it. And that's the difference between circumstantial and willful fall down. Circumstantial is excused, willful isn't. Yes.
I just to change the subject again.
Again, okay. Great.
Did you ever get to Mount McKinley?
Here's what happened. There was clouds covering Mount McKinley. And another lesson I learned from visiting Alaska is from those people that were with me that wanted me to go see it, they said that when people spend, you know, they have their trade, their income is assisting tourists who want to come to Denali National Forest and see the bears and all the moose and the elks and the all those guys. Caribou, that's what they are. Caribou. Big. And they gave me a Denali National Forest little DVD and I watched it. You know, it's wildlife. It's really nature in the raw. One of the few places left. So they want to see the nature, and that they can see, but they want to see Mount McKinley. And when they get there and there's clouds covering Mount McKinley, they said they go back really long-faced. An expectation that didn't happen. So we were 10,000 feet in the air. Mount McKinley is 20,000 feet in the air. I learned a lot. Mount Everest is taller. It's 26,000 or 28,000 or something like that. But the whole Himalayan range is very tall. So the peak itself is just a small guy. But Mount Everest, it's 10,000 and then it's 19, almost 20,000 feet, almost, you know, like not completely vertical, but very, very sharp. So we got to that part, and that was the cloud we couldn't see. We kept going, we'd bump into Mount McKinley, so we had to turn around. Because that moisture was just hovering over. You saw a glacier?
Yeah.
Glacier was awesome. When I saw that thing, I thought, because it wasn't going in a straight line, it was going. And he said, it's that glacier is about 300 feet thick. And you see those little lines over there? It looks like a crack. Those are about 30 stories. You know, like explorers would go along and they see a little crack and they'd step and it was just snow and they'd just fall in a 30-story deep thing and that's it. That's the end of the explorer. Just so powerful. And so as it's during the certain part of the season, it's warm enough that the ice will melt, but then it's cold at night, so then it freezes and it just brings more and more weight. So it just, the weight pushes the glacier. And if something gets in the way, it crushes it, it powders it. It just keeps moving. But then as the climate changes, sometimes it recedes and sometimes it grows. And
so they really are melting. I mean, they said
it's a river of ice.
Yeah.
Powerful.
I went to the Louis Agassiz Grammar School as a kid. He's the guy that lived on a glacier. I only know that because I went to
River of ice. I mean, it was seeing it from a distance, it wasn't impressive. When we flew over and saw it, like, whoa. We saw over on the side, there was some people in a tent. It looked like a little mosquito or something. Little itty bitty thing. Mountains. And then this river of ice below. Very powerful, very, very powerful.
Gives you a good picture of what we really are, what part of the universe we really are. When you said the people look like little mosquitoes, we are probably even smaller, much smaller than that, but in the whole universe.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting lecture which I was listening, you were giving in Chicago, I guess, in university about the economy and how the world is doing right now with the economy. And you were mentioning a very important point that it's the whole problem lies when it's just about human being behavior on this planet. That's why the whole situation is that because of greed and attachment.
And you can't deal with that unless you go to the platform of consciousness. You just like change the channel to another type of greed if you don't fix the problem.
They can cut, the scientists, they can cut whatever, they will make electric cars, whatever it is, but your point is extremely important. It doesn't really matter. It may, give the chance in the longer period of time.
Delay the process.
Yeah, but it's not going to change anything. People have that strong desire.
So Vyas saw that, and he saw the solution too. He gave us the cure. Anything else?